Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:14 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is April 7th. We've had a rather odd condition evolve in the gold markets. We don't see this kind of arbitrage evolve all that often. The spot price in London is trading around $1,650, but at one point today, the arbitrage with the futures price was around $50. Now, it's certainly contracted by about half into the close today, but this is still a wide arbitrage. These kind of arbitrages don't last very long in the futures markets. But one thing we can also see is that the gold price is still in a rather wide contango, particularly on the front months. And generally speaking, the price falls down into the spot price, rather than this being any kind of projection for what the price is going to be going out 5 years, but rather that is just pricing in the potential for interest rates and inflation to have an impact on futures and holding costs, rather than any kind of projection. And those holding costs and futures costs compress as we narrow the time. So it's quite likely that this arbitrage is not going to last for very much longer. But I think it's rather interesting to highlight that an arbitrage like this could even evolve in a reasonably liquid market like gold. It does tell us that we're still in an environment which is prone to illiquidity. There are a significant number of people are no longer at their desks or trying to work from home, but you can't make markets from your home. It's a FINRA rule on COMEX that market makers need to be in the office at their desks if they're going to be allowed to make markets. And that's quite relevant for all markets, not just gold. But one thing that's important, I think, to pay particular attention to is that there's a lot going on right now. It's not all just about gold. When we look at the very clear fact that the USA is now moving into a fiscal stimulus environment, this is way higher than anywhere else. In fact, it's even higher than China's, and the Chinese one is only an estimate. Well, one of the things that people were worried about last year was modern monetary theory. It scandalized the investment community, but now we have the reality of that. In fact, central banks are falling over themselves to provide the money to fund the spending programs of governments, whether that is literally handing out money to people, whether it is making loans available to all manner of businesses, whether it is telling consumers that they can skip payments on their mortgages. These are the kinds of measures that would have been considered ludicrous, if not insane, if they'd been suggested a year ago, whereas they are reality today. And increasingly, we are seeing that efforts are underway to improve upon even these more very extreme measures. In Germany, for example, they have said that they're going to make unlimited money available to small businesses. So there is a very clear effort underway to ensure that we are not going to have a depression in response to the coronavirus. But one thing that is very clear, and it is that when you give a license to people to skip payments on their debt, the buck has to stop somewhere. And in the mortgage markets, that is with the servicers, in the commercial real estate market, where large tenants like H&M and Primark and JD Sports are just refusing to pay their rents, well, then the buck is going to stop with the commercial REITs. That pretty much ensures that the mortgage market is going to lock down unless there is even more money made available to these portions of the financial sector, the non-bank banks, so to speak. It's inevitable that that's going to happen. And then you have the US Congress talking about another $1 trillion spending plan to come into effect probably by the end of the month. These are all not short-term in nature. Now, when we start to think about, well, what is the likely outcome from the coronavirus? We know, for example, that the infection rate in places like Italy and Spain is peaking. We haven't yet peaked in the UK. We have not peaked yet in New York. We haven't peaked in the wider USA. And it's still a very open question what happens in terms of the emerging markets. I've been rather, I think, reluctant to give any kind of credence to the view that the outbreaks can be easier to contain in hotter environments. The lockdown that we have in India is certainly something that's beneficial. Of course, India has a the subcontinent, the southern portion of the country tends to get very hot. The northern part of the country definitely gets winter. So that is a one factor that there are different climate zones even within a country like India. But we have certainly seen that there has been growth in or there has in the infection rate in places like Indonesia and Malaysia and Mexico, and in there is also a rising infection in Brazil and parts of Africa. So this is a global phenomenon. Now, that's one of the problems. When we look at the pace with which lockdowns can be ended, in order to end a lockdown, we need to have comprehensive testing. We need to know who's got the antibodies. The range of possibilities is extraordinarily large. It could be anything like 2 or 3% of the population. It could be 40% of the population. Upwards of 25% of people are estimated to show no symptoms whatsoever. So that 25% of people are perfectly safe. But because we still have this uncertainty, then the S&P 500, for example, was in up around 3% in here today and gave up the entire advance. It's unlikely that we're going to see the market go up in a straight line. One of the most important points, and I continue to highlight this, it's that the S&P 500 so far is encountering resistance in the region. Oops, sorry about that. Not doing a very good job of typing. Is so far encountering resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. That's the first area of potential resistance following a move like we've just seen. The most important point that I think is relevant for the wider market is that this is a type 2 top formation. We have the failed upside break, we have the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. Now, we always get this kind of argument going on after a type 2 top. It's something I've talked about in successive audios and videos, and I will continue to highlight it as long as these conditions remain evident. Some people will say, golly, we've had a big pullback. This is definitely a buy. Look at the value that's been created. Other people will say, golly, this is an awfully big pullback. I need to sit on my hands for a while. I don't know what to do about this volatility. Other people will say, I have been waiting for a pullback like this for years. We're still in a secular bull market, so I need to buy. Other people are going to say, well, the entire market has been supported by institutional investors. In this case, it hasn't been institutions, but rather it's been corporations themselves buying back their own shares. So they're going to stop doing that. It's potential that we are going to see that buybacks halve this year. And that's potentially going to improve next year or the year after, but this year it's going to halve. And that is removing a major source of demand from the market. And corporations have been buying all day, all week, all month, all year for a decade, and now they've stopped. So that is robbing the market of a source of demand. Now, when you start to weigh those up, it suggests that we're going to get a range. Now, the big question with a type 2 top is not so much whether you get a range, but rather how big a range do you get? Where does it form? Well, so far with the S&P 500, it has started to form below the 1,000-day moving average. We can also see that the 200-day moving average is starting to turn downwards, and the 1,000-day moving average is going to continue to rally. Now, the number one condition to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment is that the S&P 500 can sustain both a move above the 1,000-day moving average, subsequently find higher reaction lows, and then sustain a move back above the 200-day moving average. Now, in a bearish scenario, and this is one of the clear conditions here, we've had a very consistent period of ranging. There have been three major 18-month consolidations. Each of them was resolved with an emphatic break on the upside. Each of them, we had a consolidation in the region of the prior peak prior to the break on the upside. All of that was true until the beginning of this year. Now, subsequently, all of those consistency characteristics have been broken. One of the key consistencies was that on each of the occasions when it broke on the upside, the breakout was sustained. So the breakout has not been sustained. During each of the periods of consolidation, it found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And now we have evidence of it encountering resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. That's a major change. That is something that we need to pay particular attention to, because it is holding out the prospect that we could be in for a significantly more volatile environment overall. Now, that's potentially out somewhere in the future. But the price action is still bearish. That's the most important point. And when we look at what needs to be done, there are obviously extraordinarily large moves because of the volatility. But the clear evidence we have from the S&P is that we have a loss of uptrend consistency. And the NASDAQ, because it is a smaller index dominated by much larger companies, has got more of a classic trend-ending characteristic, or it's less far along. We can see, for example, that it got down to the 1,000-day moving average and bounced to the 200-day moving average and has now started to pause here. The minimum requirement to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment is not only that it sustain a move back above the 200-day moving average, but that it continue to hold support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. That's the minimum condition to continue to believe that we are still in a secular bull market led by technology. Now, I think there are some clear indications that that may in fact be the case. We know that the pace of technological innovation is likely to continue to accelerate. There will certainly be winners in the technology sector, and they are likely to be concentrated among the larger companies. When we look at, for example, the quantity of cash that the major technology companies have relative to, for example, the Small Business Administration, then on aggregate, they have got in the order of $500 billion, and perhaps more than that if you start adding it all together, in cash. Well, that's a substantial buffer against any kind of hit to their respective businesses. And many of these companies don't carry a lot of debt, and they haven't been buying back their shares in great numbers, although Apple is certainly an exception in that regard. But the big picture here is that what we are likely to see as a result of the coronavirus is a clear differentiation between winners and losers. There are going to be technology companies that lead us up and away in terms of a recovery. And those companies are going to be those that double down on data, on the access to data, interpretation of data, and artificial intelligence, machine learning, quantum computing, virtual reality, improving social, enhancing social interaction through virtual reality, the evolution of fusion technology, the evolution of a hydrogen fuel cell or a hydrogen-based economy, renewable energy. Those are all the kinds of themes that are likely to drive the next generation of technology leaders. But then there are going to be all the companies that have based their entire businesses upon financialization. And at the Type 3 top formation that was evident in Boeing all the way back from the beginning of this year, and in fact following the failed upside break at the beginning of last year, well, the massive decline is not simply because the entire airline industry is no longer flying and not buying planes, but rather that the planes they were building were falling out of the sky and giving all the power in the company to the accountants rather than engineers. When you are an industrial company, is an absolute recipe for disaster. It's exactly the same kind of mistakes that were made by one of the other big industrial companies in the USA, which was GE. But it's worth remembering that GE had been one of the stalwarts in many portfolios, and that it is now a fraction of where it was before and is unlikely to ever get back to the peaks that we had in 2000. But this is part of a wider malaise in the corporate sector, where financialization has been substituted for creating value and strength in the business. And the squeezing out of intangible values from the corporate sector is likely to persist for a significant period of time. We're at a point today where there is an extraordinary amount of debt in as a percentage of GDP. And we are at a point now where corporates have taken on upwards of $9.4 trillion. Debt has doubled on globally since 2007. It's also doubled in the USA. The quantity of US dollar denominated debt outside the USA is in the region of $12 trillion, at least according to the Bank of International Settlements. So the supply of dollars to ensure liquidity in the global market is essential. And we're now starting to see that the dollar is starting to weaken. This kind of acute volatility over the course of the last month is unusual for the largest currency in the world. But the Federal Reserve is printing money at an accelerating rate. It's certainly showing up on the balance sheet, but I think the more important point is that the number or the quantity of money that it is making available through swap lines, the quantity of money that it's making available through the repo markets, is out of character with the size of the US economy. We're in dangerous territory now, because the Federal Reserve is now the de facto central bank to the entire global economy. And that obviously cements the US dollar's position as the reserve currency for the world, but it also is going to reduce the purchasing power of the dollar for the simple reason that the pace with which they're printing them is accelerating. Well, then if we just simply go back and think about gold, well, there is a good reason why gold prices have been steady. And despite the fact that we have a wide arbitrage and that the futures price is likely to fall back down towards the spot price, there is still a source of strength in this market. Now, oil prices, having bounced in here last week, they are likely to, or at least the pace of the advance is likely to moderate, considering the size of the decline we've already seen. But in order to have a bullish argument, then a large amount of oil is going to have to get taken out of the market. But more importantly, it's going to have to stay out of the market. The world is awash in oil. It was awash in oil before this crisis, and there is no shortage of oil today. The much more important point is that the demand component may be topping, or at least that the demand growth argument is no longer credible. So there's a lot more competition in the energy markets. It means that the highest cost producers are going to be excised from the market, and that supply will be shut in, and that the lower cost producers are the most technologically efficient, or those that have got an all-in sustaining cost, including transportation, that is competitive, will survive. And the rest will simply disappear. That's the most likely scenario from the oil price and the oil market going forward. One thing that we can be almost certain of is that with the massive amount of stimulus that is being provided, with the quantity of dollars being provided, and with the clear incentive to try and reignite economic growth, we're going to have an infrastructure boom on a global basis. At the very minimum, we're going to see old infrastructure replaced. Thinking in a second order term, it's quite likely that some decoupling from China is going to necessitate that additional plant and machinery is produced in other countries. And that is all going to require commodities. The fact that copper prices have so far held the lows around 2016, I think, is an indication that there is an argument that some of the industrial resources are beginning to offer some support in here. But the bigger picture, of course, is that with all these dollars being produced, that we are probably seeding a new inflationary cycle. Now, the 30-year yield has compressed from 3.5% to 1.3% over the course of the last 12 months, and that's a pretty spectacular decline and rally in the price. Longer dated bonds are extraordinarily sensitive to inflation, so I do believe that this is one of the most important charts to monitor. And I think we are likely to see greater volatility until we eventually see a significant low coming into the stock market. And that might take a while. But once we do see a low come into the stock market, then we're likely to see upward pressure on yields. And if the 30-year sustains a move above 2%, then that is likely to indicate that we are back in an inflationary cycle. So I think it is one of the more important charts to monitor from an inflationary perspective. When we look at what's going on in China, they are clearly supporting the stock market. And the renminbi was a little stronger in here today with the weakness of the dollar. But they have also cut interest rates, they are reducing the reserve requirement for banks, they're making more money available in the corporate sector. There is $1.5 trillion worth of defaulted loans in China, which the distressed bond investors globally are starting to look at. Of course, that's a minefield all on its own. India is engaged in its lockdown right now, and the market has bounced over the course of the last few days. Whether it can sustain that rally is another question entirely. We just don't know yet how successful India is going to be in trying to contain its viral outbreak. When we look at some of the other markets in the region, higher population countries like Indonesia have rebounded about 25%, but the big question now is how much of that move are they going to continue to hold. I really think that it is important to highlight the fact that so many of these markets are so far below their respective long-term trend means that they could spend a long time ranging before they can sustain a move back above these levels. That there are certainly distressed signals out here right now, but we haven't really seen defaults yet, and those defaults are definitely coming, and we haven't seen earnings yet, And there are going to be some earnings shocks coming through in the next 4 or 5 weeks. So I do think it's likely we're going to get better buying opportunities, that there are going to be periods of volatility. And those are likely to provide buying opportunities for the most attractive assets. Of course, there are also going to be companies that go bust. And trying to parse which is which is going to be an important, I think, duty over the course of the next year. That also means that it is more of a stock picker's market than simply relying on passive investing. When we look at small caps, they have got a stunningly similar price, or I guess chart pattern, to large cap indices in Europe. Europe might be the biggest single economic bloc in the world, but it has been underperforming for a significant period. Now, the one difference, I think, here with the FTSE 100 is that it is loaded with companies that have long records of holding or improving their dividends. And that's going to be an important differentiator, in my opinion. With interest rates very low, with a great deal of uncertainty, one thing that investors will be keen to hold on to is their dividend and any kind of guaranteed return. Well, the UK in particular has got a very high yield, and the pound continues to recover. To me, at least, that suggests that the UK is an odds-on bet to outperform Europe, but perhaps globally, as that interest rate differential in the yield is narrowed, because if the difference in yield that we have between the S&P 500 and US Treasuries is close to its widest in history, well, it's even wider in the UK, where we have over 5% on large cap stocks and the 10-year gilt yield is at 40 basis points. And that's an incredible differentiation, and it is likely to be narrowed in a bull market scenario. Now, we are still probably going to be in a volatile environment, but these are the kinds of conditions that will eventually create value in the equity markets. When we then think about Australia, we've had the rebound. I think it is likely that we're going to get some additional consolidation. It's also worth highlighting that it's another one of these markets that is miles below the 1,000-day moving average, and the 1,000-day moving average had offered support on multiple occasions over the course of the last decade. So now the big question is how much of this oversold condition can be unwound, and will we get higher reaction lows? Will we get a type 1 or a type 2 bottom? Or are we going to see type 3 bottoms? Type 3 bottoms tend to last a long time. I think we are already in that kind of scenario in the banking sector. It's in commercial real estate, to the extent that it survives, is likely to experience a type 3 bottom. The technology sector has got the highest chances of posting a type 1 bottom, so that would be the V. And then the loss of downward momentum and subsequent massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend would be a U-shaped recovery. And I think that that is perhaps the most likely scenario for the wider market. The massive assistance that's being provided to markets from central banks all over the world will gain traction eventually. But we're still in very early days, and I don't think it is necessarily time to panic in. The one thing that I think that I personally find worrisome is the willingness of people to still buy the dip. People are just not wary enough right now. They have not been disappointed enough to really suggest that we are at the absolute low for markets. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.